Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, just back from failing to make the case for Chicago for the 2016 Olympics, Rick Hess!
Hey, Mike.
A lot of people in the education policy community said, you know, what is Rick doing putting his credibility on the line, going out there, and, you know, and how did you ever think you were going to beat Rio? I mean, come on. Who wants to go to Chicago in the middle of the summer? Everybody wants to go to Rio.
You know, people don't realize also that in Rio, it will actually be the winter during the Summer Olympics.
That's so – I didn't think about that.
I mean, see, the Chicago people, they apparently went into it way overconfident, you know, probably thinking that, you know, Rio should not deserve to host a Summer Olympics in its own winter. But
Wait a minute. So, yeah, how do they get around that problem? Wait, we lost to a country that's not even going to be summer? That's even worse. Okay. Eh. Well, it's time to get started. Eh. The section of our show where our scriptwriters wrote – banter, small talk, offensive jokes. That time has come to a close. So it is now time to get going. We have our full regular team here today, Rick. It's
liking
very exciting.
It.
We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. Then Amber will give us some information about the Research Minute. And finally, Stafford will rate that reform. Somebody put a word in the script. I don't even know what it is.
Edumacate.
Edumacate. You know, Rick, people just get too fancy these days. All right, Mickey, let's get started. Pardon the gaffe.
Okay. The Boston Globe reported this week on a suburban elementary school where parents can choose between three tracks for their kids: traditional, Montessori, or French immersion.
Wee-wee.
The principal makes it clear that the traditional track leads to higher MCAS test scores, but has anecdotal evidence that the kids in the other tracks catch up closer to high school once they return to the traditional disciplines. Should school choice proponents be encouraged by this type of model?
Yes.
Oh, Rick, come on. Mickey's bringing his A game. That's the best you can do?
Well, I mean, actually, so first off, given that Montessori is European, I do worry about the Eurocentricism of two-thirds of the curricular options. No, it's terrific. I mean, one, I'm always concerned that when schools create all these options, it's a bit like magnet schooling, that these are fancy labels. I don't know how well they're delivering any of the three tracks. For schools to actually be able to effectively and competently deliver Montessori down the hall from French immersion, down the hall from, you know, that's an open question. But if school choice is going to mean trying to allow parents and kids to find an approach that works for that kid, which shouldn't only be approaches which seem to lead or be correlated with the highest short-term MCAS scores. Mm-hmm. So this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, and I think this was pretty good leadership on behalf of this principal and the school district to say, hey, we are not going to just lavishly focus instruction on the test, but we are going to offer some other choices that we think down the road and have good results. But, you know, because we're not teaching to the test, you might not see the short-term gains. I like that truth in advertising. And by the way, I mean, this, I assume this is a suburban district, probably fairly affluent community. What do we know? We know that schools don't matter that much for these kids. Anyways, they're going to do fine pretty much regardless. All right, topic number two.
Okay. Arnie Duncan was on the Colbert Report last night, where he played some hoops with Colbert and sat down for a quick interview. In the interview, Duncan confirmed that he no longer uses the term "No Child Left Behind." Does that term deserve to die?
Well, what I love is that they have figured out if we just stop calling it No Child Left Behind, then people won't hate it as much. I'm not buying it. You know,
look, which is true, right? I mean, the EdNex polling data showed that that's true.
Well, it's okay, sure, the brand. But then, okay, they're going to come up with some other name for it, right? The Audacity of Hope Act or whatever it's going to be, right? But if it contains the same stuff, which it's likely to, then eventually people will hate that brand. So it only does, I guess it buys you a few years maybe, but
it buys you for 2012.
The problem is not that the four words No Child Left Behind, it's that that came to be, you know, associated with, you know, kind of testing and over-the-top sanctions and all the rest. So they got to change the substance too. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. And I don't think that they're going to change the substance a whole lot.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seemed, especially, I guess, in the stakeholders meeting last week. I mean, I didn't go. But from what I read about it, I mean, it sounds like Duncan is clearly suggesting that they're going to walk away from more of NCLB than it looked like they were going to walk away from 6 or 8 months ago.
I would just still say, you know, watch what I do, not what I say.
Oh, believe me, I'm with you.
And you say how they've, you know, what's happened with the stimulus and with the race to the top, and you say, look, this is, if he really believed in not being prescriptive, if he really believed in you know, more flexibility in return for results, it hasn't showed up in the race to the top yet.
Mm-mm.
And so I think the same – look, the same power centers are still – having a huge influence. It's the Gates Foundation, it's the Trust, it's some of these other groups that, you know, are still basically in charge of the conversation, and, mm-hmm. and they fundamentally don't like too much flexibility. I mean, if you read David Brooks' column this week, he talks about how the government can get involved in promoting innovation, you know, and there's two approaches, and one is to say, hey, I got all the answers, I'm going to figure out all the answers, I'm going to implement it from Washington. Another one is much more laid back. I'd be very surprised if we see that laid back style really win the day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, topic number three.
Okay, in a couple reports we saw this week, a lot of recent ed school grads are having a tough time finding work. What do you think?
I think a lot of people are having a tough time finding work.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much. I mean, look, do I feel sorry for ed school grads? Here's who I feel sorry for. Did you see that in the Wall Street Journal report the other day, perhaps because of the rise in the minimum wage, that the unemployment rate for black teenagers is now over 50%? I mean, think about that. That I think is devastating. Some ed school grads out of work? I don't know. I'm not too devastated. Rick, what do you think?
No, not terribly.
I mean, a couple of things. First of all, a lot of ed school grads never went into teaching to begin with. I mean, that we know that there's a huge number of people getting these degrees that just never go into teaching, perhaps because it's an easy degree to get. So we got to be careful with this. But yeah, I mean, the bigger problem is that we have tons of talent out there right now, people looking for jobs, including the Teach for America types, who can't get them because school districts are cutting back. We have a situation in Ohio where we have roots as Fordham. You know, we're looking at a 10% across the board cut this year to education budgets, probably 15% next year. Charter schools get all their money from the state, so that means those charter schools they could just get wiped out in one blow. The urban schools get most of the money from the state. That's a big hurt for them. The suburban schools have the local property taxes, so not as much. But, I mean, you know, there's serious stuff that's going on right now, and it's a real shame. We've got talent out there we could be picking up, and we don't have the opportunity to do it.
That's right. I mean, you know, the shame would be if we're not cherry-picking good talent from folks who graduate from ed schools or elsewhere. And, you know, that's what we'd like to see, is districts using this as a chance to cleave off a lot of the less effective teachers and prime themselves for smart hiring.
Yeah.
And we're not doing that. They're keeping everybody on the rosters in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, frankly, the descriptive stats on the wide swath of ed school of graduates suggest I'm not terribly concerned about whether or not we're getting all these guys. I'm not sure that many of these are folks we want in the schools.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got places, we just reading about Hawaii, where they've got these furloughs every other Friday. So they decide basically, what's that strategy? That's basically we're going to reduce all teachers' salaries by
20%
and instructional time. Instead of having the guts to say, you know what, we're going to fire some teachers, we're going to allow class size to rise, but we're going to keep kids in schools, and hey, maybe we could fire teachers that aren't effective.
I mean, which means we can shift kids from ineffective teachers' classes into classes with effective
right,
teachers.
Right, but we don't do the politically hard work, Rick.
Mm-mm. Mm.
But you know what? We don't take that attitude here on the Education Gadfly Show.
What attitude do we take?
We are all about high standards and expectations, and you know who meets that just about every week? Amber Winkler and her research
just
minute.
About every week. Did we notice that?
Well, you know,
he's still mad at me for that research paper minute, the creative paper minute or whatever that was.
Look, Amber, I'm telling you, we have a high standard
report. He's never going to let me forget that.
Well, you know,
most weeks is pretty good.
The nice thing about trying to have high standards to make tough decisions on the Gadfly Show,
yeah,
is that we don't actually have to do anything.
Yeah.
It is much easier to make tough decisions this way. I like it.
Yeah. That kind of burst a hole there in my whole argument. Okay, Amber. I feel bad we kind of talked over your musical interlude.
Yeah, it's all right. You know, you were just ribbing me. I had to pay attention to
ribbon back. She had a rib back.
She did.
I did.
Rib taken. What are we talking
about?
We're ready.
This week, we got a brand new Fordham report out that reviews the latest draft of the Common Core Standards in Mathematics and in Reading, Writing, Speaking, and Listening that were developed by the National Governors Association, Achieve, the College Board, and others. We used expert reviewers, most of whom have worked on our state standards reviews in the past, to review the Common Core Standards, as well as compare them to other de facto national and international standards and tests, namely NAEP, TIMSS, and PISA. In short, we wanted to know which of these documents are worthy for modeling national and state standards. Bottom line, our experts thought the Common Core standards were in fairly good shape. Both the math and English language arts standards received a B. The biggest concern with the Common Core math standards was that they did not set priorities. The biggest concern with the reading, writing, and communication standards was that the states might mistake them for a full language arts curriculum when they are meant to be more skills-based. In other words, the report cautions that states need to supplement these skills-based standards with literary content. Finally, the other test, the only A of the bunch, was TIMSS. NAEP reading and writing got a B. NAEP Math a C, and PISA reading and math finished dead last with D's.
Whew, nicely done, Amber.
Hmm.
So now it's our turn to shoot holes in our own study. Okay. I mean, this is a little bit like having, you know, the New York Times assign a book review to the author of the book.
True.
I just want to put that out there in case, you know, we're going to get mail from people saying.
Absolutely, but I think we need to let people know that we've got a study out, and it's interesting, it's relevant, and everybody, the national standard scene is on everybody's radar, and we're the first to come out to the gate, you know, with a really thoughtful review of them.
Absolutely. All right, so let's say this again. So the new Common Core draft standards get Bs.
Mm-hmm.
They're not quite as good in math as TIMSS, which gets an A,
mm-hmm.
But they are at least as good as NAEP, in some ways better, because NAEP gets kind of B's in a few things, C's in others,
mm-hmm.
and PISA sucks.
Right.
Okay. So that's the bottom line. All right. Fair enough?
We did not use the word sucks in our report. I'll have our listeners know.
That's right. Okay. Checker would not allow that. All right. So, but the, now some people will say, now how can you compare these things? Isn't this apples and oranges? Some are standards, some are test frameworks. So what do you say that?
Well, we said that they are used that way. In other words, people look at NAEP, people look at PISA and TIMSS, and they, you know, they use them for benchmarking purposes. They kind of use them, teachers use them to see, you know, what's important in terms of what I need to teach. So we kind of made the argument that, you know, even though they're not standards per se, often they're looked at by policymakers and practitioners as important for informing the debate in terms of what content is important. So yeah, in the end, we judged them for what they were purported to be. So in other words, a PISA reading was judged as, you know, a reading document, not as an ELA document. We did sort of, you know, judge them for what they purported to be.
Right. Mm. Now let's talk about that reading versus English language arts. So the mm-hmm. Common Core standards, they're all about skills, right? So they say, mm-hmm. you know, somebody at 12th grade should be able to comprehend a document and like blah, blah, blah. But they mm-hmm. don't actually say we expect kids to have, you know, read at least one work of Shakespeare or all of that. And there are some out there who say, look, you cannot separate. Dan Willingham, for example, mm-hmm. At UVA says you cannot separate reading skills from content, that there is no such thing as a reading skill. Once you get past decoding in, you know, right. kindergarten or first grade, it's all about content. So mm-hmm. what do we say to Dan and others?
Yeah, and your experience as well. You know, he talks at length, which I think was a relevant argument, that, you know, if you read a comprehension passage about baseball and you've played baseball, then you're, you know, at a much greater advantage. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that kids' experiences plays into how well they read as well, you know, was a relevant point he made. So I think he raises some great, you know, things that we need to think about in terms of how the standards drafters have articulated English language arts in this document.
Or really reading, writing,
listening, speaking.
And again, it's tricky because, I think Dan makes a good point, but then you don't just need to worry about English literature content under mm-hmm. his argument. You also have to worry about history content and science content mm-hmm. and art, you know, and then suddenly you're like, wait, what kind of standards are these? So,
right.
Yeah, it's tricky. So what they're trying to do is say, look, here are the skills that kids need, and then this has to be, if you want to actually teach these skills, you've got to embed them within an English curriculum, a history curriculum, et cetera.
Yeah. And they do give a nod to, you know, interdisciplinary content and the importance of that. I mean, so, you know, it's not like they were oblivious to.
Though, I mean, partly how you set this up, because set up slightly differently, you're back at the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, and the same folks who are saying, oh, these are pretty good frameworks of skills, would be saying, wait a minute, where the hell's the content?
Mm-hmm.
The you know, it's simply that by saying, oh, these are only meant to be meshed around content,
mm-hmm.
that this suddenly becomes, you know, easily palatable for folks.
Yeah, and you know, how is this going to work? So states are going to adopt these skill standards as part of their standards, but they're going to have other English language arts standards that wrap around them, and
right.
Those are going to vary by state. The assessments, I guess, will just be on the skills, and so then the worry becomes that English literature classes pay less and less attention to Shakespeare and more attention to these skills.
Well, absolutely. Right, so then it all becomes about how states happily implement, about the test banks that get constructed around this, and what teachers are, you know, and pretty quickly you're back in Massachusetts having the debate that we're seeing unfold right now around Governor Patrick's proposal on rethinking standards.
But we understand why they didn't want to fight that fight.
Oh, sure, sure. But it is interesting that they wind up with the good grades from you guys because they ducked the fight.
Right, because we scored them for what they said they were, not what we wanted them to be.
Right.
We applaud them for ducking that fight. That's right. All right, Amber, thank you for that. Wait, sit back down.
Sorry.
I know. What song goes along with this phenomenal new study?
We were running late. Well, since we're talking about what we really, really want with standards, we have the Spice Girls with Wannabe.
Now, very nicely, and I like the head bobbing, but I will say this is exactly what people worry about, that the content that surround these standards are going to be all fluff.
It's amazing to see Fordham giving high marks to this stuff. That's what's astonishing.
Look, they are very clear about what these things are. They say these are reading, writing, listening, and speaking standards, and so as those, they are pretty good at doing that.
But for Fordham, for a pretty darn long time, hasn't Checker and haven't Diane explicitly said, well, that's fine, but first and foremost ought to be academic content?
That's not what they went after.
So the key to getting high marks from Fordham is duck and weave, and you'll come out okay, huh?
By the way, the math standards look pretty good, but there's reasons to believe that the validation committee, which is stocked full of people who love PISA and things like that, could still mess them up.
Well, and I love that your critique is lack of a failure to deal effectively with prioritization. Many people think that's a substantial question in curriculum design.
Well, you imagine what was wrong with PISA then, for it to get a D. All right, Stafford is here with Rate That Reform. Okay, Stafford, what are we rating this week?
This week, we are talking about the Lone Star State.
Ooh, rate it.
Oh, the Lone Star State. Well, it is common knowledge that Texas has a rather draconian penal code, punishments that may or may not fit the crime, but this story from El Paso really knocks it out of the park. And I'd like to pause right here and give a shout out to Marcy, senior editor at Fordham, who sent me this story. Thank you very much, Marcy. So a 10-year-old boy with special needs acted up in class, falling asleep and becoming angry when he was woken up. He then ran out of the classroom, made noise in the hallway, and lay down and refused to get up. Instead of being sent to the principal's office, suspended, or sent home, the school called the cops, who slapped him with a Class C misdemeanor and a $260 ticket. According to his mother, the medication... Is this funny?
Yes.
I think it's terrible. The boy's 10 years old.
I like the ticket.
According to his mother, the medication the boy takes for his behavior disorder makes him drowsy and was probably the reason that he fell asleep in class. And the district says the Texas family law was what legally backs up their actions. A student who is 10 years or older can be cited for this kind of disruptive behavior. But a local news reporter who investigated these claims said she only found relevant law in the Texas Education Code, which doesn't even specify the age of the student who is eligible for this kind of punishment. Sounds like a mess to me, but anyway, anyone who's ever been a kid, been around kids, or had kids, in other words, everyone, should find this story outrageous.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, bad behavior is something that should have consequences, but acting up, especially when the behavior in question is medically related, should not result in a 10-year-old kid getting a juvenile record. So I gave this one an F.
What I want to know is what would have happened if a teacher had exhibited the exact same behavior? I don't know that they would it have been illegal or protected.
How often do you hear about a kid getting a ticket? This is the funny part. I mean, they could have come and hauled the kid to the principal's office. You typically would hear about a 3-day suspension or something.
Yeah.
Attention. They get a ticket for $260.
I hope that they're smart enough to keep that ticket and frame it and have some fun with that down the line.
Well, I should say in follow up that the mom took the issue to court and I think the ticket got dismissed. But the fact that this is even in Texas law in the first place, that you can ticket 10-year-olds for acting like a 10-year-old is a little bit over the line.
Did they have to read the kid his Miranda rights?
Ooh.
We got a 10-year-old sleeping in the hallway.
You have the right to remain silent. Wait, you're asleep. That's not a problem. Okay, that is all the time we have this week. Till next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.